tonight. I'm talking about some of the theological issues connected with the idea of laws of nature. Specifically, I'm going to talk about the theological foundations that originally underpinned the idea, as well as the theological implications of some recent challenges to the concept. But first, I thought it might be worth explaining just a little bit about why I chose to talk about this topic. As Robert said, my PhD thesis was in the history of science. I was looking at relations between natural philosophy and theology in 17th and early 18th century England, specifically with regards to natural theology. One of my main arguments was that in the 17th century, natural theology was not as distinct from revealed theology as is often assumed today. Rather than seeking knowledge of God apart from revelation, natural theology was primarily an apologetic exercise, developing arguments from reason and knowledge of nature in favour of doctrines originally known from the Christian scriptures. This could be helpful for convincing people of the truth of Christianity if they didn't accept the scriptures as authoritative, but it was also helpful for supporting the faith of people who already believed. And it was the way in which relations between theology and natural philosophy could be mediated. For example, by using its roots in support of religion, the pursuit of knowledge of nature could be justified. Also, it could be argued that a particular system of natural philosophy was more consistent with Christian theology and therefore better reflected reality. This point, as we'll see in a little while, was particularly relevant with regard to the laws of nature. Now, I could have spoken tonight about this topic, but I've already spoken about it a number of times, including at ISCAST's Conference on Science and Christianity last year. And besides, after so many years of working on it, I thought it was time to move on to something else. So tonight I'm talking about a topic that is a little bit different, although it has some links to natural theology, which is divine law and the laws of nature. What this means, however, is I'm talking about a topic that's relatively new to me, although it has some connections with the research I've been doing for the past few years. The advantage is that preparing for this talk has been very interesting. The disadvantage is that I'm really still at the stage of figuring out the topic for myself. And all the preparation that I've done for this talk has raised more questions than answers. But I'm hoping that there'll be something new or at least interesting for all of you this evening. The other point that I want to make before starting properly is that I'm approaching this topic as a historian of science. I'm not a scientist or a philosopher. I have a science degree in pharmacology, but I've never used it. My PhD research was on the 17th century, and while I am interested in contemporary discussions about science and religion, I'm a little bit out of my depth with regard to some of these issues. So I'm particularly looking forward to discussion at the end, because I want to know, particularly from people in the audience who are scientists and who use these kind of like concepts in your everyday work, I'd like to know how well what I'm saying fits with your understanding and experiences of nature. Some of you might be aware of the theological and philosophical debates surrounding the idea of laws of nature, but others of you might simply take the concept for granted and not even know that some people have challenged it. So I'm hoping that we can have a fruitful discussion together. So then, if I am a bit out of my depth, why am I talking about this topic anyway? Well, my interest in the topic first developed out of preparing for a job application for a postdoctoral research position, and I'll talk a little bit more about that research project a bit later on. So I wanted to get something a bit more out of the time and effort that I spent preparing for the application and the interview, given that I didn't get the job. And secondly, I came across a post earlier this year written by the popular Christian blogger Tim Challies, who some of you might read. He asked, is it right for Christians to understand that there are laws of nature? So Challies acknowledges that nature is clearly governed in some predictable ways, but suggests that it's better for Christians to understand the laws of nature in terms of regularities rather than laws. There are two main reasons, which have to do with our understanding of God's providence and the occurrence of miracles. Firstly, if we think that there are laws of nature, we might think that these laws keep the world running, allowing God to kick back, relax, and merely watch over everything without needing to be continually involved. The only time he gets involved is to perform a miracle, a violation of the laws of nature. Secondly, if we believe in laws of nature, Challies argues, we understand something that is inviolable. We might even think that God himself cannot violate these laws, and thus miracles are impossible. Challies' conclusion is that neither of these views is consistent with an understanding of God as creator and sustainer of the universe, personally involved with his creation. I initially found Challies' argument intriguing and a little puzzling, because when the modern concept of laws of nature first emerged, it was founded on and justified by theological considerations. For virtually all the early proponents of this view, the laws of nature only worked because God was continually upholding them. Indeed, the idea of a world governed by laws of nature was the result of a new view of nature in which God was directly involved. Further, although God imposed these laws of nature, he himself was free to contravene them at any time he wished. However, the laws of nature did fairly quickly become separated from their original theological foundation, and indeed they were used to argue against the very possibility of miracles. In more recent times, however, the idea of fixed, inviolable laws of nature has been challenged, not just on theological grounds, but also because it doesn't seem to fit our experience of nature in some ways. So Tim Challies is, I think, unintentionally reflecting a view that is fairly common among philosophers of science and religion. Still, it is interesting to note that the early proponents of the laws of nature had no issue with divine and miraculous intervention in the world. We'll return a bit later to contemporary understandings of laws of nature and God's action in the universe, but now we'll have a look at the emergence of the concept of laws of nature in early modern Europe. Scholarly discussions of the emergence of the concept of laws of nature form part of a broader literature that might be characterized as debunking the conflict thesis. Many people believe that science and religion have been eternally locked in a vicious struggle for dominance and authority, from which science will inevitably emerge victorious, or perhaps it already has. The popularity of this idea can be traced back to two significant works of the late 19th century by John William Draper and Andrew Dixon White. Although this notion of conflict is still common in popular culture today, particularly amongst certain of the new atheists, it has largely disappeared from academic history of science. Indeed, since the 1930s, there have been many and varied attempts to show that Christian theology and religion played a significant and positive role in the development of modern science. Attempts to explain the rise of the concept of laws of nature are part of this. Although the concept is often taken granted for today, this was not always the case. Now, when I'm talking about laws of nature, what I'm referring to is this modern concept of specific and precise statements providing mathematical descriptions of exceptionless regularities. Now, if you are a scientist, particularly in the biological sciences, you might recognise that this definition applies more to the physical sciences, but this was the concept as it emerged in the 17th century. How well it applies to the various branches of science is something that was debated a bit later on. So for the moment, we'll just take it as a standard definition. While there were earlier notions of order in nature, and of course the concept of natural law with regard to morality, this modern concept first emerged in the 17th century during what is commonly termed the Scientific Revolution. While there's a huge amount of debate amongst historians about what exactly happened during the Scientific Revolution, and even if there was a Scientific Revolution, there is a general consensus that the 17th century witnessed a dramatic change in the way in which the natural world was studied and understood. Aristotelian natural philosophy, which had been dominant since the Middle Ages, was challenged by a variety of competitors, but eventually replaced by an experimental, mathematical, and mechanical natural philosophy. Within this new natural philosophy, the laws of nature became central to the pursuit of knowledge of the natural world. There were four key differences between Aristotelian and mechanical natural philosophy that were particularly relevant to the emergence of the modern notion of laws of nature. And as we shall see, all these differences have an underlying theological justification or motivation. Firstly, the new mathematical and experimental natural philosophy of the 17th century transgressed traditional disciplinary boundaries. For Aristotle and Aristotelian natural philosophers, there were three main branches of knowledge. Firstly, there was natural philosophy, which dealt with things that change and exist independently of us. This is the natural world. This is the main realm of knowledge for understanding the natural world. Secondly, there's mathematics, things that do not change but have no existence independently of us. And thirdly, metaphysics, which deals with things that exist independently of us but do not change. So natural philosophy, or physics as it was sometimes called, was the discipline that dealt with knowledge of the natural world. It purported to explain the entire universe and the relation of that universe to God, however conceived. There were four main questions that any system of natural philosophy sought to answer. Matter, what kind of stuff is nature made of? Cosmos, how is that stuff organized? Causation, how do things happen? And method or epistemology, which is how do I get the answers to the first three questions. In addition to natural philosophy, mathematics and metaphysics, there were also a series of specialized fields such as mechanics, astronomy and optics, which applied mathematics to aspects of the physical world. For Aristotelians, these mixed mathematical sciences were considered subordinate to natural philosophy. The mathematical descriptions of physical phenomena were considered to be convenient fictions, useful for calculation and prediction, but not reflective of the reality of nature. The reason was that describing something with mathematics did not actually explain anything in terms of causality. As an example, we can... shows the different answers to these four questions by the Aristotelian and mechanical natural philosophers. But we'll come back to some of those issues. So we have here, this is the structure of the universe according to Aristotelian natural philosophy and astronomy. So in the left-hand one, this is the standard geocentric model of the universe, where the planets are surrounding the central Earth on crystalline spheres. So in Aristotelian cosmology, the sun, moon and planets move in these perfect circles on these spheres around the Earth. If you were doing astronomy like Ptolemy, however, and you wanted to be able to predict the motion of the planets, you needed some very complicated mathematical devices, and you end up with something that looks more like this. This is actually the orbit of only one of the planets around the Earth. But in order to make the movement of the planets fit with what we actually see, you needed some very complicated mathematical constructions called epicycles and equants and a whole variety of things to make it fit. But no one believes that the planets literally move like that in these convoluted cycles. It was just a convenient mathematical calculation. But because this mathematical model did not reflect reality or explain causation, it was not natural philosophy. It was subordinate. Mathematics was not considered an appropriate method for natural philosophy. And incidentally, this was one of the key issues at stake in the Galileo affair. The Catholic Church was quite happy for Galileo to use the Copernican model of the universe as a convenience for calculation, but Galileo insisted that it was a literal reflection of reality, and also insisted that the Church reinterpret scripture accordingly. And the rest, as they say, is history. And you would know, I'm sure, that the reason for all these epicycles, which is still present in Galileo's Copernican system, is that the planets actually move in ellipses and not circles. That's one of the reasons, anyway. So Galileo was one of a number of key thinkers of the early 17th century who wanted to introduce mathematics into the sphere of natural philosophy. This movement was partially a result of the re-emergence of Christian Platonism in the Renaissance, which stressed the reality of mathematical relations. The idea was that if mathematics was a product of the divine mind, why should geometrical and mathematical relations not be genuine features of the created order. As Galileo put it, philosophy, that is natural philosophy, is written in this grand book, the universe, which stands continually open to our gaze. But the book cannot be understood unless one first learns to comprehend the language and read the characters in which it is written. It is written in the language of mathematics, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures, without which it is humanly impossible to understand a single word of it. Without these, one is wandering in a dark labyrinth. But insisting that mathematics should be used in natural philosophy was a radical step, as other natural philosophers of the time clearly recognised. This is beeping. Is that a problem or...? Okay, still seems to be working. Okay. For example, when Johannes Kepler introduced his mathematical laws for the motions of the heavenly bodies, which of course, as you all know, used ellipses instead of circles, he was aware that he was transgressing traditional disciplinary boundaries. However, he appealed to divine will and his belief in a creator as the justification for his realist mathematical astronomy. He said, "I shall have the physicists, that is, the natural philosophers, against me in these chapters, because I have deduced the natural properties of the planets from immaterial things and mathematical figures. I wish to respond briefly as follows, that God the Creator, since he is a mind and does what he wants, is not prohibited in attributing powers and appointing circles from having regard to things which are either immaterial or based on imagination." So while for the Aristotelians the laws of mixed mathematical sciences were human constructs or rules of calculation, for Galileo, Kepler and other 17th century natural philosophers, God had created the world in such a way that mathematical laws are not just human constructions and devices for calculation, but rather describe the real relations that exist between physical objects and the universe. Kepler's laws of planetary motion were not just a convenience for mathematical calculation, but a reflection of reality. And by the end of the 17th century, it was possible for Isaac Newton to publish a book titled The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, something that would have been an oxymoron for Aristotelians. So that's the mathematical natural philosophy. Secondly, in Aristotelian natural philosophy, the world was understood as being something like a living organism, whereas in mechanical natural philosophy, the world was seen as... Oh dear. So where we're up to is that in the 17th century, nature came to be understood as being like a machine or a mechanism. This machine was created by God and could do nothing without God. And if God had created the world and ruled it directly, why wouldn't he issue physical laws like the moral edicts that he gave in Scripture? And further, understanding the world as a machine or a mechanism also strengthened the case for incorporating mathematics into natural philosophy. The mechanistic model of nature meant that the kinds of mathematical devices and laws that were used in the previously subordinate science of mechanics could now be applied to nature itself, again opening the way for mathematical laws of nature. Thirdly, the modern concept of laws of nature required a particular understanding of matter itself. For the 17th century natural philosophers, the laws of nature were imposed externally by God rather than being intrinsic to natural objects. The atoms or corpuscles that the mechanical philosophers understood to make up the natural world were basically dead matter. They could do nothing on their own, but required the direct input of God for anything at all to happen. Whereas for Aristotelians, God's control over the world was mediated by properties he had implanted in natural objects. For the mechanical philosophers, God needed to be continually involved. We can see this in Robert Boyle's description of the two main points taught by the corpuscular or mechanical philosophy. Now, if you're familiar with Robert Boyle today, it might be for Boyle's law in chemistry. He's often known today as the founder of modern chemistry. But he was a very very significant natural philosopher of the 17th century who also wrote a lot about the relationship between natural philosophy and theology. And according to Boyle, this new corpuscular or mechanical philosophy taught not only that God gave motion to matter, but that in the beginning he so guided the various motions of the parts of it as to contrive them into the world he designed they should compose, and established those rules of motion and that order amongst things corporeal, which we are wont to call the laws of nature. And secondly, that the universe, being once framed by God, and the laws of motion being settled and all upheld by his incessant concourse and general providence, the phenomena of the world thus constituted are physically produced by the mechanical affections of the parts of matter, and what they operate upon one another according to mechanical laws. It's very wordy descriptions, but the key points here are that these corpuscles of matter that make up the universe only possess motion because God gave it to them, and that all the phenomena of the world are produced by the motion of this matter, governed by the laws that God imparted and continues to uphold by his providence. Now this does raise a significant question. How can inanimate matter obey laws in any but a metaphorical sense? But this again leads us to God, as William Paley recognized over a century later. Paley noted that reflection on the natural world will lead to the conclusion that the laws of nature everywhere prevail, that they are uniform and universal. But what do you mean by the laws of nature or by any law? Effects are produced by power, not by laws. A law cannot execute itself. A law refers us to an agent. Inanimate matter can only obey laws if God wills it. And finally, the particular laws of nature that God had imposed on the natural world needed to be discovered by empirical observation. This notion developed from medieval debates about God's will, power, and wisdom that were revived after the Reformation. In the Middle Ages, voluntarists such as William of Ockham emphasized the primacy of God's will, stating that creation was entirely contingent and that therefore there could be no a priori demonstration of physical phenomena. Intellectualists or rationalists, exemplified by St. Thomas Aquinas, argued that God's reason was prior to his will and that there is some necessity in the created order, whether God created it or not. Thus, a priori demonstration is possible, or at least to some extent. These debates were revived in the wake of the Protestant Reformation, as the reformers were concerned to re-establish the sovereignty of God with regard to salvation and with regard to the natural world. While Greek natural philosophy had emphasized the idea of laws or properties immanent in nature, 17th century natural philosophers preferred the concept of laws imposed on nature from outside. And since God created the universe by his own free will, unconstrained by any external considerations, the only way to know what the world is like, or to know what kinds of laws are present in the world, is to go out and look at it. So what we have in the scientific revolution is a change in natural philosophy from Aristotelianism to the new experimental, mathematical, corpuscular natural philosophy. And this change was grounded in and justified by theological considerations. The adopters of this new natural philosophy believed that it was more consistent with Christian theology than the old Aristotelian system. But because of this change, and particularly because of the associated theological issues, a modern concept of laws of nature could be adopted. Now, as I noted at the beginning, one of the criticisms of the concept of the laws of nature, such as that expressed by the blogger Tim Challies, is that we might think God simply set up the laws and then left, and that he's no longer involved in the universe on a regular basis. Or we might think that not even God can violate the laws of nature. I think it's interesting and instructive to see that both these ideas were considered completely absurd by 17th century mechanical natural philosophers. I'd like to illustrate this with reference to Walter Charlton. He's not particularly well known today, but he was one of the earliest adopters of the mechanical natural philosophy in England. All of the quotations that I'll be using are from a work of natural theology. You can see here the connection to my thesis, which was called The Darkness of Atheism Dispelled by the Light of Nature, was published in 1652. For Walter Charlton, to suppose that God created the world and then left was simply foolish. Although God made all things perfect, nothing can have existence longer than he shall please. If God were to abandon his creation, everything would fall apart. Just as light disappears when the sun descends below the horizon, so also must the world disappear and be lost in annihilation if God discontinued his providence. So God did not simply set up the laws of nature and then leave. Instead, he continues to sustain nature by upholding the laws. Now, nature is bound to act according to laws determined by God, who made nature and prescribed the rules for her to act by, from which she cannot vary without a miraculous dispensation. However, God himself was free to contravene these laws. For most certain it is that God never limited his free omnipotence by any fixed law, or bound up his own hands with the same settled constitution whereby he circumscribed the definite activity and duration of his creatures, it being the prerogative of his nature to know no impossibility, but to be able to act either above or against the statutes of his deputy, whensoever and upon what subject, and to what end soever he pleases. In this quotation, God's deputy refers to the laws of nature. God's providence is acted out in the natural world by the laws of nature, which he himself instituted. However, as this quotation suggests, while nature itself is bound by these laws, God is free to contravene them at any time. And this would be easy for God. Nothing can be a miracle to him, to whom all things are not only of equal possibility, but of equal facility also. For Charlton, it was a manifest contradiction to believe God capable of creating the natural world, yet unable to change the laws of nature at will. Charlton pointed to the historical incidents of miracles, such as the flood in the time of Noah and the darkening of the sun when Jesus Christ was crucified, as evidence that God hath, in times prelapsed, frequently manifested his prerogative of causing effects not only superior, but also contradictory to the ordinary and established laws of nature, his ordinary instruments, when such effects seemed either necessary or expedient to his providence. Consequently, it would be foolish to think that God could not do this at any time he wished. To believe him to be the author of that mighty and difficult miracle, the creation, and yet doubt the supremacy of his power by conceiving that he cannot turn natural agents out of their common road, must be a manifest contradiction and an absurdity that stabs itself. Which I thought was a particularly nice turn of phrase. Just don't get writing like this anymore. Now, what I've presented so far is it's a general historical understanding of the concept of laws of nature, and just one example of a natural philosopher who had no issue with a God who created laws but retained the prerogative to break them. Other natural philosophers at the time did have slightly different views of the laws of nature based on their particular understanding of the nature of God. Ralph Cudworth, who was one of a group of philosophers and theologians known as the Cambridge Platonists, believed that God's goodness and wisdom took precedence over his omnipotence. While Walter Charlton emphasized God's free will in setting up the laws of nature and breaking them as he wished, Cudworth's distaste for the Calvinist doctrine of predestination encouraged him to reject any hint of arbitrariness in God's actions. For Cudworth, to emphasize God's free will and omnipotence would jeopardize the very notion of intelligible creation, because such a God could not have been constrained by rational considerations. So in his natural theological work, The True Intellectual System of the Universe, Cudworth wrote that a mechanical philosophy, the example he gave was Descartes' Cartesian hypothesis, makes God to contribute nothing more to the fabric of the world than the turning around of a vortex or whirlpool of matter, from the fortuitous motion of which, according to certain general laws of nature, must proceed all this frame of things that now is, without the guidance of any mind or wisdom. For Cudworth, this was an unacceptable view. Matter was incapable of acting according to laws on its own. A law cannot execute itself. And God would surely not deign to intervene continually in the ordinary workings of nature. So Cudworth argued that what the mechanical philosophers referred to as the laws of nature was just another name for what he called a plastic nature. This plastic nature was a kind of spirit that acted as an intermediary between God and nature. Whereas for Charlton, the laws of nature were God's deputy. For Cudworth, it was the plastic nature that maintained the mundane operations of the natural world, removing the need for God to be involved in every little detail. In his ideas here, Cudworth was primarily arguing against the views of the French natural philosopher René Descartes, who I have a picture of, but I'm not going to say too much about him, primarily because I ran out of time while writing the talk. But in general terms, for Descartes, the laws of nature and even the laws of mathematics were created by God's free will. In fact, God was so free that he could have made 2 plus 2 equal 5 if he had wanted to. But once he created the laws, his immutability, his constant nature, meant that he wouldn't change them. So, of course, a lot has happened in the last 350 years since these people were writing. And today the laws of nature are no longer connected to their original theological foundation. Despite the religious motivation of the 17th century natural philosophers who developed the concept, the idea of laws of nature inevitably led to a view of the world in which God was no longer needed to explain anything. The laws of nature became a fundamental assumption of science, and their theological origins have been largely forgotten. The importance of the concept of laws of nature in science is nicely illustrated by this quotation from the German physicist Max Planck. How do we discover the individual laws of physics, and what is their nature? It should be remarked, to begin with, that we have no right to assume that any physical law exists, or if they have existed up to now, that they will continue to exist in a similar manner in the future. It is perfectly conceivable that one fine day, nature should cause an unexpected event to occur which would baffle us all. In such an event, the only course open to science would be to declare itself bankrupt. For this reason, science is compelled to begin by the general assumption that a general rule of law dominates throughout nature. But note here that it is no longer God who upholds the laws of nature. While the laws of nature are fundamental to science, such that we can't even do it without them, all we have is the hope that nature will continue to act in the same way. Of course, there are still philosophers and scientists today, obviously, who believe that God still underpins the laws of nature. And one example is the scientific theologian Alistair McGrath, who writes that the laws of nature are not arbitrary, but a permanent expression and embodiment within the world of the mind of God as creator. Without this theological foundation, there is no basis for supposing that the natural world will always behave in a regular, ordered fashion. But does the world always behave in a regular, ordered fashion? The concept of laws of nature as universal and unbreakable has been challenged in recent decades by some philosophers and sociologists of science. And this leads to questions about how God can relate to his creation. Sometimes it seems to me that atheists want to have things both ways. If there are laws of nature, then miracles are impossible. But if there aren't laws of nature, then how does God relate to creation? Seems that's a lose-lose situation for us. But even atheist philosophers of science seem to be interested in how we might understand God's relationship with his creation if we dismiss this traditional idea of laws of nature, although this is possibly due to the large amount of funding that they can attract from the Templeton Foundation. So we have here a project funded by the Templeton Foundation that's headed up by Nancy Cartwright a philosopher of science and economics at the London School of Economics. It's titled God's Order, Man's Order, and the Order of Nature. And what Cartwright writes in her description of the project is that since the scientific revolution, natural philosophy and Christian natural theology have united to place man in a well-ordered universe and with powerful arguments. Appearances notwithstanding, so the argument goes, the empirical and conceptual successes of modern science testify that we live in a world in which every natural event is the outcome of universal and immutable natural law. This image even survived quantum indeterminacy and chaos theory. The universe is still universally law-governed, though some of its most basic laws are probabilistic and some events may always be beyond our ability to predict. In recent decades, however, a number of philosophers, including Cartwright herself, have challenged this view of the laws of nature. There are a number of quite varied views on what scientific laws are actually like, most of which I'm still struggling to understand. But this is a list that comes from one of Cartwright's publications about the research project. So one idea is that laws are cateris paribus, that they only hold all other things being equal. The idea that some basic laws don't even totally describe ordered behaviour. Laws emerge historically. The sources are contingent, therefore the laws are contingent. There's quite a long list, and they're not all particularly relevant to the discussion today, but I just wanted to give a bit of an idea of how people have challenged the idea of laws of nature. But what I would like to do in the time left is to take one of these views and one theological account of it and examine the view of Keith Ward, who's a philosopher and theologian, on miracles and the laws of nature. Now, interestingly, I was at a conference in Brisbane last week, the Australasian Christian Conference, the Academy and the Church, and I was speaking on this topic, but in a shorter version. I had a quotation and a picture of Keith Ward up on the PowerPoint at the end of my talk, and one gentleman who came in late asked me if Keith Ward was my pin-up boy. He was relieved when I said no, because Keith Ward, although he has been an Anglican priest, his version of Christianity is very liberal. Some of the views that he expresses on his website, he says, "I am by nature and conviction an idealist philosopher, someone who believes in the supremacy of mind, of spirit or mind, and who thinks that the material universe is an expression or creation of a supreme mind. I see religions as very ambiguous, but probably necessary ways of giving humans some awareness of this supreme mind." His liberal view of Christianity means, as he puts it, "I do not accept the inerrancy of the Bible or of any system of dogmas, and I welcome constructive disagreement and diversity of belief. Also, I believe in a liberal God, one who desires the flourishing of all sentient life so far as is possible, and who will not condemn anyone who shares that desire." And so apparently he believes that even a sincere atheist might be saved. But despite being so liberal in his theology, Keith Ward has some very interesting things to say about science and religion. And so I'd like to examine his way of understanding the laws of nature in a theological framework. Ward acknowledges that for early proponents of the laws of nature, there was no inconsistency with the idea of miracles. For Isaac Newton, for example, while all phenomena could be explained by a few simple laws, God was free to break his own laws, and hence miracles were still possible, as we have also seen in relation to other mechanical philosophers such as Chalton. But what Newton and the others didn't seem to realise, however, was how odd miracles would now seem. Though Newton himself believed in miracles precisely as divine interferences in the clockwork of the universe, it quickly became clear that the better the clockmaker, the less he could have to interfere. In a universe wherein everything that happens can be explained according to laws of physics, the hypothesis of God becomes superfluous, except as something to keep the system going. The development of mechanical natural philosophy and laws of nature in the 17th century led fairly quickly to the idea of nature as a perfect, self-sustaining machine, a closed causal realm of universal and unbreakable laws. And it was this view of the world that led David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, to define miracles in such a way that they are always impossible. As he put it, a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, and as a firm and unalterable experience has established these laws, the proof against the miracle, from the very nature of the fact, is as entire as any argument from experience can possibly be imagined. But given that the idea of exceptionless laws of nature arose quite late in human history, how firm and unalterable is this experience? Developing and understanding scientific laws is not a matter of simple experience. It requires a precisely controlled environment, sophisticated instruments, and a highly trained observer to take and interpret measurements. As Keith Ward puts it, whose firm, unalterable, and uniform experience establishes the law of nature? Only people who can solve differential equations, who are capable of postulating unseen atoms underlying the objects we perceive with our senses, and who can devise precise laws stating ideal relations between these atomic particles. So really, it's only the firm and unalterable experience of a very small subset of the human population who can establish the laws of nature. But of course, for Christians, the universe is not a closed causal realm. We believe in a God who interacts with his creation. And as we have seen, even atheists question the view of the world as completely closed and governed by exceptionless laws. What science cannot account for is the possibility of spiritual causation in the universe. So Keith Ward's idea is that purely physical laws have exceptions when they are modified by spiritual purposes. Note here that the laws are modified rather than broken. He says, there are no otherwise unbreakable laws that have to be arbitrarily broken by an external interference, and we do not have to think of some invisible person suddenly deciding on a whim to break a law. All things being equal, or ceteris paribus, the physical laws of nature hold. Our mathematical descriptions of nature work with supreme accuracy in relatively closed or controlled conditions. But we don't know for sure that there is nothing else to be described, or perhaps even beyond description. And if God intervenes, then the physical laws will be modified. One point that I found particularly intriguing in Keith Ward's discussion of miracles is that Christians can view the resurrection of Jesus, or the resurrection of anyone, not as the breaking of a physical law, but as the modification of a physical law that dead bodies gradually decompose by a spiritual law, that all the dead will be transfigured and will rise again. And so what we have is a modified spiritual law. Normally bodies decompose, but in special circumstances, perhaps if humans are wholly filled with a divine spirit, that tendency to decompose is checked. In this way, the resurrection of Jesus could be seen as unusual in timing, but not in occurrence. He was, after all, the first fruits of the resurrection to which all Christians look forward, as Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Of course, such spiritual laws are beyond the power of science to discover. But given the right testimony and theological context, it might not be irrational to believe that a miracle occurred. This requires faith, but this faith is not belief without evidence. As Keith Ward puts it, what is required is a commitment to a loyalty and discipleship that evaluates the evidence for the existence of God in the facts of nature, the historical evidence of Jesus' life and teaching, and the personal experience of millions of believers in a positive way. And so his conclusion is that miracles are not totally inexplicable. They are just not explicable by known scientific laws. They are not irreproducible, but since only God can reproduce them, they are beyond the powers of science to reproduce. Now, when I presented this talk last week in Brisbane, I was focusing primarily on Tim Talley's question of should a Christian believe in laws of nature? And I concluded with Walter Charlton that if we do believe that God created the universe and imposed laws of nature, then it's kind of silly to believe that he cannot overrule those laws whenever he likes. However, even in the last few days of expanding the talk for tonight, I think I'm leaning more towards this view of Keith Ward, that what we call laws of nature are descriptions of physical regularities that generally hold, that can be modified by other conditions, such as the presence of spiritual causes. I think that this allows for a view in which God upholds a general regularity in nature, but he doesn't merely intervene arbitrarily. After all, we believe in a God who is faithful in maintaining nature and who created the world in such a way that we can understand it. However, physical laws do not preclude God's continuing action in the universe. He is not constrained by our science. And that's where I'd like to leave it. And